You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything. Feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are and live with all your faults. I want to wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so I don't cry.
Montana Man likes this song. Montana Man hadn't been on the net for a while. So I'll have to call him today and counsel him. All right, now what you're about to hear is General Berger testifying alongside of Admiral Moran. Admiral Moran has since been shown the door because of some transgression with a former public affairs officer that behaved badly at a party that Admiral Richardson didn't boot out of the Navy quick enough and removed from his staff quick enough, so Admiral Richardson got caught in a blast. Then, evidently, subsequent to that, Admiral Moran kept a professional relationship with the guy. Blah, 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 blah. Anyway, it was deemed to be unfit. So Moran is out, and Gil Day? Hold on, I'm not saying his name right. Let me get it right. The new CNO is Gil Day. Thank you. Well done, Mac. All right, so I'm going to play the testimony, and you're going to get to hear it. And then I might cut in on occasion, because I found, as I was cutting it up yesterday, again, I've learned how to do, like, geek stuff efficiently. So, do we really want to hear 2 hours of testimony? The answer to that is no. All right, so what do we want to hear? Well, we want to hear General Berger talk about Marine Corps stuff. Okay. So what do you have to do? You have to listen to the 2.5 hours of testimony, and you have to clip it, right? And you have to clip it. So anyway, that's what I did. Anyway, here you go. Here's General Berger talking. General Berger, let me just tell you what's pretty cool. General Berger's mom and dad were there. Yeah. I thought that was really cool. You know, he had brothers and sisters that were there. His mom and dad were there. I was like, man, that's awesome, man. That is absolutely, positively awesome. So, anyhow, here's General Berger testifying in his confirmation hearing. Probably a few weeks ago now. But I thought you should hear it, and today's a good day to do it.
Chairman Inhofe, Ranking Member Reed, and distinguished members of the committee.
This is General Berger's opening statement.
Thanks for the opportunity to appear before you today. I'm truly honored to be nominated as the 38th Commandant of the Marine Corps. Here with me today is my wife, Donna, who has given as much to the Marine Corps over the past 38 years that we've been married as anybody I know, including me. Through all the deployments and all the PCS moves, she's been a tireless advocate of military spouses and their families and has immersed herself completely in every unit we've served in, from the highs of the happy deployment homecomings to the lows of combat losses and casualty assistance calls to young spouses in the middle of the night. Not only is she a great mother, for our 4 sons, she saw 2 of her boys join the Marines. 1 son went to Iraq, the other to Afghanistan, and I honestly don't think Donna slept a full night when each one was deployed. Three of our sons are here with us this morning, and Don and I are really incredibly proud, like Admiral Moran is, of each one of them and their families. They each have made their own way in life, and their success is really heartwarming to me and Donna. Also with me today are my mom and dad. They are my role models in life and probably my biggest supporters. I have a brother and a sister here and a whole bunch of other family and friends as well, and Don and I are just really tickled that they could be here this morning. I am grateful to this committee for your resolve and your unwavering support for our service members and, as the ranking member Reed said, for their families. Our men and women in uniform need to know that their nation is fully behind them, and your actions reflect that steadfast support from our citizenry. I know that we have the best trained, the best equipped, best led force I've seen in my lifetime. We also have the very best leaders setting the tone out in front of them, setting the personal example in everything that they do. Some of those commanders with full knowledge that some of the decisions they must make in combat put human lives at risk. It is humbling just to serve among their ranks. General Neller, over the past 4 years, skillfully guided our Corps through some challenging times as we recovered from more than a decade of sustained combat in the Middle East and shifted our focus back towards our naval roots. That we have largely recovered our combat readiness while concurrently beginning to modernize the Marine Corps for the future is a testament to the clarity of General Neller's vision and his steady hand at the helm. And I am grateful for his leadership, his mentorship, and his friendship. Your Marine Corps fills a unique role in the defense of our nation. As General Krulak once said, we make Marines and we win battles. We typically do not win wars. Our goal is always to go quickly. We will be first to fight and do all humanly possible to prevent a crisis from becoming a war. When it comes to national defense, your nation's Marines are the first responders, and much is expected of them. We must be ready at all times, highly trained, expeditionary in nature. We must be both lethal and compassionate, for we will not have the luxury of choosing the next conflict or the crisis. This nation demands the highest professional standards of her Marines, and we are accountable for our actions to you and to them. These are not unreasonable demands, and we work very hard to keep our honor clean. If confirmed as the Commandant of the Marine Corps, I will ensure that Marines live up to the expectations of this committee and the American people 24/7. I will ensure your Marines are always ready to go when called, but I will also look after their welfare and care for their families so that we return better citizens to society when they complete their time in uniform. I will maintain a focus on proper care and support for our ill and injured and those wounded in combat. I can think of no greater honor than to continue to serve among their ranks and lead them as the 38th Commandant. Thanks again for the opportunity to appear before you this morning, and I look forward to your questions.
General Berger, we've gone through a period. Well, first of all, let me compliment you. I had a team over there in the South China Sea. We started off in Hawaii, and I'm not the only one at this table up here that doesn't like PowerPoints. And what you did instead of a PowerPoint was something brand new. You had maps in front of you, and you kind of walked us through. And that was so. You teach somebody else how to do that too, will you? We know what happened during the last administration. The priorities were not on. We had our brigade combat teams. Only about 30% of them could be deployed. Same thing with our Army aviation brigades. I think that's 35%. Our F-18s that we use there in the Marines, we only had 40% of those that could actually be used in combat at that time. And we saw this taking place. The general public was not aware of this, but we were at this table aware of it. Now we have, they were down to 40% on the F-18s. I'd like to, and I think the Secretary of Defense has talked about 80% as an expectation. Where are we now? We've done some improvements in the last 2 years. Where are we on that?
Senator, the 80% goal set by the Secretary of Defense was for all the services, and we've all been working hard to get there. I think first I'll say up front, we would not be where we are right now in terms of readiness in TAC Air or anywhere else without the support of Congress and the oversight that you provided to make sure we were spending it on readiness. And it's happened. It's we're not where we need to be yet, but we're on the right path.
Yeah, give me a percentage.
On the F-18s and the F-35s together for the Marine Corps, the goal is 80%. Last week, F-18s hit 80%. F-35s hit about 74%. So I think both the Navy and the Marine Corps are paying close attention to it. There's things out of our control that we can't, you know, we don't have a crystal ball. But I think the path that we're on should make it doable later this year to reach 80%.
Okay, well, that's a better answer than I would anticipate in this short period of time. But we also know that there's movement within that, so it's going to go up and down and not maintain a percentage, and I understand that. A lot of systems right now, the Air Force is going through replacing the KC-135 with the KC-46, and after many, many years, the CH-53 Echoes came around, and I think it's 1981, and now we're looking at dramatic improvements. And although the cost had looked has come in anticipated to be pretty high, would you comment on this moving to the CH-53 Kilo model, and why?
Sir, just a couple quick thoughts there to answer the question. The 53K. First of all, the program has been restructured based on the testing that was done over the past 18 months by the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Gertz, and the vendor, Lockheed Martin. So that has been restructured the program, and thanks to this committee and Congress for authorizing a reprogramming of funds to make sure that the testing could continue. I'm confident that that aircraft will meet our requirements, and the requirements remain valid. It will be the heaviest lift helicopter we own in the U.S. military. It has greater range, greater speed, greater reliability than the 53 Echo, which you mentioned is approaching 30 years right now. I'm confident that the oversight means are in place, and that both Secretary Gertz and the Marine Corps leaders are watching it closely. But that's an aircraft that can do what no other aircraft can. We need it.
Yeah, and we know, we hear the costs on this, but initially we understand that costs are going to be higher. And I am concerned about that. When you just look at it and you say $100 million for a helicopter, when right now we're at about $80 million for a strike vehicle. So,
if you didn't hear that, it was $100 million for a helicopter and $80 million for, I think he said, a strike vehicle. I mean, think about that. I mean, that's $100 million for a helicopter per copy. Pretty amazing.
We want to follow that real closely, which we will be doing. Thank you very much, Senator Reid.
For both Admiral Moran and General Byrd, the Secretary of the Navy submitted a top 10 list. This is not the top 10 list you want, of Marine Corps and Navy installations who are most vulnerable to severe weather. And do you believe that we should adopt, i.e. the Department of the Navy and the Marine Corps, better installation resiliency planning and guidance as a result of weather threats? Admiral Moran?
Sir, there is no question that we need, and we are developing a plan for greater resiliency, especially in areas where we have shipyards and communities that share water space, share waterfront. Those are really important areas for us for obvious reasons. And we are largely a waterfront service, so climate change, when there's rising waters, are going to be a problem for us if we don't address them. So we are in the planning stages to look at how to reinforce those areas.
And General Berger.
I'd agree, sir. The two biggest challenges are the rising water levels and severe storms that roll up the coast and through our bases and stations. I think the new standards for construction, for military construction, are absolutely critical. When we recover from a storm like we are now in North Carolina, we need to look at the location of the buildings. We need to look at the construction standards of the buildings to make sure that they'll survive, you know, what the climate's going to throw at them. But absolutely, it's an important factor for us, and the standards for construction are very helpful.
And following up to, in a more general way with the chairman's questioning about acquisition programs, over the last several years, the NDAA has given the services more opportunity to participate in acquisition. Can you give us a sense of whether we're headed in the right direction? What's the dynamic between these undersecretary, defense for acquisition, in terms of the service chiefs and South View, Admiral Rand? I only have brief time, so
yes, Senator. I think we have all the authorities we need as a result of the work of this body, and we appreciate that. And if confirmed, I will actively participate in all the programs to make sure that we get requirements right and that we can deliver on time.
Don Berger.
I'd echo that, sir. And having gone through the process for the first time this wintertime, reviewing each major acquisition program together with the Navy and Secretary Gertz, it's a very deliberate process, and I saw the service chief has a mechanism to weigh in on the health of the program. It's very good.
Yeah, one just final point very quickly is that one of the things that's depressing more and more is it not just the cost of the platform, but the sustainment cost of the platforms going forward. I think most Americans would be startled if they realized that the sustainment cost on an hour of flight of an F-35 is $34,000. That's a little bit more than I think most Americans on the street would assume was a cost to keep an aircraft aloft. But thanks.
All right, in case you missed that one, $34,000 for an hour of flight time for an F-35.
Gentlemen, both for your service.
Thank you, Senator Reid. Senator Wicker.
Mr. Chairman, these are two outstanding nominees. It's great to hear from them today. General Berger, I've heard you say today that with the leadership of people like General Neller, we've largely recovered from some of the cuts we had to sustain. You mentioned first to fight being the role of the Marines, decisive power. And yet, the recent OMB budget removed amphibious ship production from the FY20 budget proposal. The proposal would be to put the LPD procurement in 2021, LHA procurement in 2024. When it comes to first to fight and decisive power, General, can you explain to the committee in this unclassified setting how an LHA with an F-35B squadron or an LPD with high mobility artillery rocket system expands the effectiveness and utility of the U.S. amphibious forces? I think we have the flexibility and we have the capability and smarts to find a way to move money around and go ahead and stick with the plan that we enacted last year.
Sir, it's going to sound a bit parochial, but I don't believe there's any more versatile capability than an embarked Marine force on an amphibious ship. And our requirement, as agreed to by the Department of the Navy, is 38 amphib ships. That's the current amphibious ship requirement, 12 big decks and 26 LPDs and LSDs, or LPD Flight 2.
And I might interject, that's the opinion of General Dunford, Secretary Spencer, and Secretary Gertz.
Correct, sir. And to answer your latter part of your question, Senator, what those four deployed Naval Expeditionary Forces, for example, F-35s on a big deck do, they are, I don't know of a more effective deterrent. There probably are equals, but I don't know of a more effective one. And as far as a contact force forward, that gives you the capability to present a deterrence force, and if the adversary chooses not to comply, then you can turn offensive very quickly.
Do you think we have the flexibility in the DoD budget to ensure that LPD and LHA procurement programs remain on track and that no funds from either LPD or LHA procurement can be taken for other purposes?
All I can tell you, Senator, is from the Marine Corps perspective, I know what the requirement is. And I also know that the Secretary and the CNO have a larger portfolio of requirements. Ships are part of that. So the best I can do as service chief, if confirmed, I think, is make sure the Secretary, the CNO, understand what the Marine Corps needs, and then have the discussion about the greater needs of the Department of the Navy.
Okay, let me ask. I appreciate that emphatic statement, and I think that's helpful to the committee. Let me ask both of you then, and I'll begin with you, General. And the chairman alluded to this. The time we the previous 8 years, we had to deal with sequestration and continuing resolutions. What would be the effect this year on the requirements that we have and your ability to be first to fight and deliver lethality if we had to deal with a continuing resolution at the end of this fiscal year, or even worse, go back to sequestration, which is in the statute today. Unless we change the statute, we're back at sequestration. And we got a minute and a half. I'll start with you, General Berger, and then go with you, Admiral.
Sir, and I'll be brief. If it's a continuing resolution, based on my experience, commanders below us have to make hard decisions on what's in their training plan, and they'll have to probably delay some of those or cancel them. Procurements are going to be delayed. New starts you cannot do under a continuing resolution. And the worst part about it for us is the unpredictability. You don't know how many or how long the continuing resolution will last. So at best, you try to hold your head above water with what you've got. But what really happens is an erosion of readiness, and in jeopardy is procurement. If it's a BCA, sir, and very quickly, it's even more catastrophic. Just if I could add just one final thought, sir. What would happen is, especially in the Naval Service, we would make sure the next deploying forces are ready to go. And we would triage everything else in the service to make sure they're ready to go. But readiness and the rest of the fleet non-deploying would start to fall off.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Wicker. Senator Shaheen.
General Berger, in his opening statement, Chairman Inhofe talked about the challenge of balancing our operations in Afghanistan and Iraq with the competition we are facing from China and Russia. As I think I said to you when we met, I joined Senator Reid and Senator Jones on a trip to Iraq and Afghanistan over the last 2 weeks and saw firsthand the impressive work that's still going on there by our men and women who are serving and what they're doing to keep ISIS from coming back in Iraq, to continue to combat the threat of al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan. But can you talk about the challenges that it presents for us to have those continuing operations when we're trying to ramp up to address what's happening with Russia and China?
The rotation of forces that you were fortunate enough to visit is on a regular basis, and they go through a pre-deployment training program, ma'am, that's deliberate, and it's focused on the assigned mission that they're going to have there, which isn't necessarily their core mission, but it's what they'll have to do while deployed. Many of the skill sets are transferable. Some are unique, as you're alluding to. Overall, we balance the force based on the maritime deployment requirements as amphibious ready groups and marine expeditionary units against the requirement to fulfill our commitment in the Middle East. I'm confident the units that go there, and I know who they are well trained. I'm also confident that when they return, they'll get right to work on the skill sets that atrophied because of their focus, unique focus on a counterterrorism mission.
Thank you. You both talked about the challenges of addressing the changes that are happening because of our climate. And I think you referenced General Berger construction standards. As you both are looking at the construction standards, the need to have a plan that's more resilient, that addresses how to respond to these storms in the future, are you also looking at efficiency as part of any rebuilding or the efforts that are going on to respond to climate? General Berger?
I didn't know much about that aspect of our bases and stations, frankly, till I was at 29 Palms. And when you're a base commander and you look at the energy bill, you get smart on that real fast. The standards written into them, as the Admiral said, are now part of the design. And the silver, gold, the ranking system is very effective. And the return on investment for the base commander is huge if he monitors it closely.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you, Senator Sheen. Senator Cotton.
Gentlemen, thank you both for your service to our nation and for being willing to answer the call to serve once again. Thank you in particular to your wonderful spouses and all they've done to enable your service and the example.
Senator Tom Cotton, former United States Army infantry officer, Republican senator from Arkansas. Pretty squared away dude.
They've said for our military spouses in both the Navy and the Marine Corps. I want to talk to both of you about pilot retention. It's the issue on which I have focused in the Air Force. We've seen some of the same issues in the Navy and the Marine Corps now. I'd just like to hear from you what we're doing to retain these pilots if we spend so much time and money in training them. General Berger, you want to start with the Marine Corps efforts?
Well, on the front end, Senator, recruiting always has been a focus. I think now even more so. Not specifically the numbers, but more looking to, we may lengthen the time of service that their initial obligation is so that we can train and then get the benefit on the back end, because, like you mentioned, their pipeline for training is longer than it was 10 years ago. On the retention side, very targeted bonuses, incentives for them to stay. I think there is no question within the Marine Corps. We know the competition from the airlines is here now, and it's not going to go away in a year. The third part, though, Senator, is the readiness improvement in our platforms is critical in retention, because pilots come in to fly, and if we can't give them but 6 or 7 or 8 hours a month, after a while, that gets really frustrating. The recovered readiness, in other words, on our aviation platforms is huge. The more they fly, the happier they are, better we are as a service. So we have to keep readiness high. It's directly related to retention.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. This is actually one case where I think throwing a lot of money at the problem won't make a difference. Those bonuses are nice. We should reward our service members, especially in the most skilled positions. But General Berger, as you said, you're never going to be able to pay as much money as an airline, and your young pilots joined the Marine Corps and the Navy to fly high-performance aircraft against bad guys in defense of our nation, not to make a little bit more money, even though that's welcome. And I bet Lieutenant Moran might not have stuck around to be Admiral Moran if he only got 4 or 5 hours of flight time a month and was only spending the rest of his time making PowerPoint slides. So I'm glad to hear that you recognize that part of making sure that we retain the world's best pilots in the Navy and the Marine Corps. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Senator Cotton. Senator Blumenthal.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and I want to join in thanking you both for your extraordinary service and your families. General Berger, when we talked about the Marine Corps Special Operations Command, MARSOC, at one of the subcommittee meetings, you indicated that you wholeheartedly support this national asset, and in fact, it is developing, as you said, quote, further and faster than most thought possible, end quote. I assume that MARSOC will continue to be a priority of yours as Commandant.
That's correct, Senator. It will.
And do you agree with General Neller that much of what your service does in the future will not be against a near-peer adversary, that, as you say, the Marine Corps must be versatile and nimble in responding to challenges of battles as an expeditionary force?
As I mentioned in the opening, Senator, my experience is we won't forecast, we won't predict what the next crisis is. And I think you require our naval service to be ready to operate against any threat anywhere across the range, from a non-combatant evacuation or a typhoon recovery all the way to the high end. We don't have the luxury of picking a single threat and training against it. We know what our peer pacing one is, but we have to be ready to operate across the spectrum.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I swap places with Senator King to accommodate him to get to another hearing.
That's acceptable.
Thank you, Senator. Title 10, Section 151B, the functions of the Joint Chiefs. The first thing that's listed is military advisor to the president. That's the function of the chairman, but it also is the function of the members. I think that's your most important job. Will you commit to this committee and to me that in this position you will provide your best, unvarnished, truthful advice based on your deep military experience to the President of the United States, to the National Security Council, in all situations involving the possible use of military force? Admiral Moran?
No question, Senator.
General?
Yes, sir.
I have one bit of homework, although I suspect you've already done it. I think anybody entering a position of that you're entering should read H.R. McMaster's book, Dereliction of Duty. It is a classic study of a failure of policy during the Vietnam era, and it focuses very specifically on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So I can't emphasize enough how important this is, and your terms are 4 years, so you'll certainly be advising this president for 2 years, perhaps for 4 years, or perhaps another president. So this isn't president-specific, but I'm just suggesting that you're absolutely truthful advice, again, based on both of your extraordinary careers, is what the country needs and demands, and I appreciate your commitment to that.
I think, Senator, the most visible symbols of the military around the U.S., in my opinion, are reservists and their reserve units and recruiters, frankly. Those are the ones that are the most visible. But to your point, the service has an obligation to actively communicate with the public. Those are visible presence out in the communities, but we have an obligation to communicate with the people about what their taxpayers' dollars are getting for their defense and why what we're doing is so important. I don't think that's something we can ever take for granted, in other words. We have to do that proactively, and that's to be part of our jobs.
And I appreciate that, and I think broadening your reach in terms of recruitment, the citizen soldier is a part of the history of this country.
It's a pretty interesting discussion, and the backdrop of this discussion is the declining demographics of our nation that qualify for military service. Now, like 75% of the people in the United States do not qualify for military service. And how do you broaden that footprint, right? Outside of, and I'll get to a discussion here about, I can't remember what percent, and I think it comes up in the discussion, of military members are sons of relatives of somebody who's already served. So it's these legacy military families, like mine, both my sons have served. That, you know, two of my nephews are now serving. All that comes from family ties. And so, how does that work? So anyway, interesting discussion here about broadening the footprint demographically through recruiting and whatnot.
It would be a shame. My worry is that the military is over here, and the public doesn't have that much connection with what it is you do, what your values are. So I commend you for those efforts and hope it, and I think you said, Admiral, active measures. This isn't going to happen by itself.
Thank you, Senator King. Senator Ernst.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and gentlemen, thank you very much for stepping forward and taking on, hopefully, additional levels of authority. I want to thank your family and friends for being here today as well. Welcome to all of you. Gentlemen, both of you have talked a little bit about emerging threats and want to do a little deeper dive there. Admiral Moran, you stated that if confirmed, you do intend to continue the Navy on a path forward towards a more agile, sustainable, and capable naval force to meet new and emerging threats. And General Berger, you stated that if you are confirmed, your goal would be not merely to meet new and emerging threats, but to maintain a margin of overmatch over potential adversaries. So, gentlemen, if you would each maybe describe what you believe to be the most threatening emerging adversary or capability that might be out there, and then how do we compete? And General Berger, or Berger, to your words, how do we overmatch in those areas?
I think Senator, well documented, well covered is the fact that both Russia and China watched us pretty closely over the last 15 years, modernized, and frankly focused against a single adversary, us, for a decade and a half or more. And when you can do that and you don't have global commitments like neither of them have, you can make up some ground, which they have. I think the cyber threat that my battle buddy Admiral Moran mentioned, absolutely, we assume. It's there every day right now, and we assume they will go after that early on and constantly. Because some of our leaders have spoken of that as a center of gravity or a critical capability for the USO. They will absolutely go after our networks, for sure. So we have to harden that, and we have to train our people and change their behavior to, frankly, treat the network a little different than they treat it at home.
Mm-hmm.
On the how do you maintain overmatch, there is a hardware technical aspect to that and a classified aspect. But in this forum, ma'am, I would say people and training, although not always talked about first, sometimes we talk about platforms and equipment, I would tell you people and training are, that's where it begins. Having the very best people in the Navy and the Marine Corps with the very best leaders in front of them and really hard, challenging, realistic training, that's how you maintain a margin. In other words, even if your equipment is peer-to-peer, we have to train harder. We have to recruit and retain the very best.
I appreciate that. So bottom line, we've talked a little bit about unmanned systems, hypersonic, cyber. Artificial intelligence would fall into this area as well. Just bottom line, if we fall into sequestration, we can guarantee all of that stops, correct?
It certainly slows down to a point where we will fall further behind in some of those areas. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. General Berger, just very briefly, because I have 1 minute left. Earlier this month, the Corps concluded an experiment integrating female recruits into an all-male unit for their initial training at Parris Island. Can you just give me a quick overview, and if confirmed, based on those results, would you pursue further gender integration during Marine Corps basic?
That company graduated a few weeks ago, started with about 50 females as part of the company, you're probably aware, ma'am. We measure the same things in every company that goes through there, how well they did physically, how many injuries they had, all those sorts of things. The statistics, to answer immediately your question, for this company were the same as every other company, a few areas higher, a few areas lower, but it went great. The program of instruction that we use in the Marine Corps, we didn't change. We just changed where they were billeted, and it all worked out. I talked to the Commandant this morning about it and the results of it. I think, what I asked him is, I said, we have to look at this perhaps for next year. And he said, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a discussion he and I will have and the Marine Corps will have. But the class that entered in January and graduated a few weeks ago did very well.
That's good to hear. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I look forward to supporting you. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, gentlemen, for your past service and your willingness to continue to serve.
Thank you. General Berger, your current position is commander of the Marine Corps Combat Development Command, which describes itself, I think, as, quote, the institutional intellectual epicenter for the evolution of the Marine Corps. So in responding to a question from Senator Ernst, who I serve on the Emerging Threats and Capabilities Subcommittee with, you talked about some of the emerging threats and capabilities. But my question for you is doctrine. You've thought a great deal about that. And given the change of warfare, which will likely be dramatic in the years ahead from the autonomy we talk about to hypersonic missiles, et cetera, What do you see as some of the challenges to doctrine, and how do you think about that going forward?
Doctrine we think of as evolutionary. It's, to your point, it's a tough match in today's world as fast as things are changing. So I think the way that we're approaching it now, and we'll see how that goes, is as fast as possible move the concepts for how we're going to operate as a naval force, Navy plus Marine Corps force. Move those concepts forward and experiment really, really aggressively. The doctrine will lag, I believe. But if we slow down the experimentation and the concept process to the pace of doctrine, we'll fall behind. So I think the effort that Admiral Mertz and his team in the Navy and the Marine Corps has done over the past year and a half in really moving forward how distributed maritime ops will work, having advanced naval technology, exercises and demonstrations where vendors can bring their stuff and we just put Marines and sailors in front of them and say, this is what we got to be able to do. What do you got that's close to that? That's how we're going to move fast. We'll bring doctrine along, but we will not allow it to drag us down like an anchor.
The current Marine Corps operating concept is from 2016, which was before the National Defense Strategy was published. Do you see a need to revise that, and what would be your timetable?
We are looking at that, Senator, but in the interim since 2016, two documents on the Navy Marine Corps side have helped flesh out what the Marine operating concept sort of hinted at, and that's littoral operations in a contested environment and expeditionary advanced base operations. So although the Marine operating concept was sort of the beginning part of that, the two follow-on documents and then distributed maritime operations, they've all taken the idea further in advance. So I don't know at this point if we need to rewrite the mock. The following documents have helped a great deal.
Right. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Senator Peters. Senator Sullivan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to thank Admiral, General, both of you for your decades of service and the service of all your family members. Great to see so many here. Thank you for answering the call on these important positions. As the chairman mentioned, the National Defense Strategy emphasizes the return of great power rivalry with China as the pacing threat in the Indo-Pacific as the primary theater. In this committee, in the last three NDAAs, has not only emphasized that, but has also emphasized and required the Department of Defense to do much more with regard to a strategic focus on the Arctic and our forces there. So what I want to do is focus a little bit of my questions in these two areas. Despite the NDS focus and the discussion of the Arctic here, the force posture of the Marine Corps in particular, but also the Navy in that region, to a lot of us seems stale. And by that I mean it's pretty much, if you look at what the end of World War II left with regard to force posture, that's where our forces are pretty much right now. Would you agree to work with this committee on looking at ways in which to optimize the force posture of the Navy and the Marine Corps in the Arctic and in the Indo-Pacific? General, do you agree with that in terms of the force posture and how we need to update it?
I think Admiral Davidson highlighted that as well in his testimony. And ongoing DPRI effort to reposture the forces, part of that discussion.
General Berger, I have a question or two for you. I read an article recently that I was very interested in, written by Major Spader in a publication that I wasn't familiar with before, but it was just an interesting article. the publication is called War on the Rocks, and the article, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, Sir, Who Am I? An Open Letter to the Incoming Commandant of the Marine Corps. I don't want to summarize it because there's a lot of good points in there, but I think maybe a main point is the Marines are our Swiss Army knife. They do everything, but sometimes trying to be everything to everybody is a real challenge. And so we have to be, Marines have to be first to fight, and you have to be flexible in dealing with the challenges. We focused on terrorism. Now it's great power competition, but the bombing in Sri Lanka shows that ISIS is, if they're not holding a caliphate, they're nevertheless still active all over the globe. How do you approach that question of not wanting to just be everything to everybody as a nominee to be commandant?
It was a fascinating article. There's more venues now for creative people to write, and they're all good. I think they ask questions that were asked internally, yeah. But now there's a means for them to ask them out loud. The basics of it for me, Senator, to answer your question, we know what our pacing threat is. That doesn't mean necessarily we're arming up to go after them or them after us, but that's the bar we must measure ourselves against. Now, all other missions are not subsets of that, but we can adapt. If we have the force that matches up against a peer adversary and maintains a margin of overmatch so that it's not a fair fight, like General Dunford says, as long as we're there, we can adapt that force to do any other mission we're assigned. But the opposite is not true.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Perdue.
General, I appreciate your comment. We never want to send our kids into a fair fight. And you've said that repeatedly in here. 27 March 1794, this Congress passed the Naval Act of 1794. And it authorized six ships to be built, first six ships in our history. They happened to be frigates, and that was a very controversial decision, as I understand it, at that time. Today, I'd like to talk about two things real quick. The need, and then our ability to fund it. Those six ships cost us $688,000. Today, we're in a different game. I'd like to talk about, first, the buildup that China has and how we can have that overmatch, General, both in the Marines and in the Navy, Admiral, when in 30 years we're seeing that they're going to have about 100 more ships in total. Professor Andrew Erickson, the Naval War College, has actually said that his estimate is that they will be quantitatively larger and qualitatively on par with us by 2030. Do you both agree with that statement? And if so, how do you plan to deal with the fact that, you know, they're able to bring ships quicker and cheaper to bear than we are in the procurement process? They're not limited by the funding things that I want to get to in a second. So if you'll address that.
This is the part of the hearing that I thought was really, really, really interesting. A look into the future. It looked into a situation where the United States is not the dominant power, but very much a peer, and without counting our allies, is actually inferior to Chinese naval power. And the problem with that is power projection. The Chinese projecting power in a way around the world that the United States cannot, except with our allies, project that. And what that means to the world order. So really, really interesting. And I think it gets to this issue of shipbuilding, not being able to do it on time, not being able to do it under budget, and that which the Navy scuffles with.
And I'd like to hear your response from both of you, if don't mind. Admiral?
Senator, great question. I think it's pretty clear to all of us that our military advantage over the last 17 years in this great power competition against high-end adversaries like China, potential adversaries like China, our advantage is eroded in many different ways, both in terms of quantity and in terms of modernization. The quality of our force that's modernized, trained, manned, and equipped the way we are on a path to do right now, I would take anywhere, anytime against anyone who wants to take us on. Together, not just the Navy Marine Corps team, but the Joint Force, and you add in the Air Force and the Army, it's incredibly powerful in this great power competition. So we have to maintain pace on modernizing the fleet with capabilities that can counter the capabilities that are being generated by China.
And you're confident then by 2030 with the NDS strategy right now, 355 ships, that we can do that with a 100 deficit to the China's capability?
Yes, sir, I do.
Thank you. General?
Sir, the technological part of it, there's obviously an unclassified and a classified portion to that answer. And I mentioned before, so I won't cover it again, the importance of realistic training and the ability of the Navy Marine Corps team to operate together and as a joint force. No one can compete with us right now on that level. Now, they're going to work hard to get to us, but right now we can operate in a way that they cannot. But we should not take for granted, and we shouldn't sit on our laurels neither. The middle ground, of course, between us is partners and allies, which you didn't mention, but we have to work hard to make sure we are the best partner, the best ally, every single day, every week. So it is partly a function of system versus system, numbers versus numbers, but there's another aspect to it in terms of who can help a region maintain security framework that exists that's so successful. Right now it's the U.S. We have to work hard every day to ensure that the partners and allies, in Admiral Davidson's case, in Indo-PACOM, in the other combatant areas, that no matter how far another country advances, that collective framework is strong enough to deter any bad actors.
Yes, sir. I wish we had more time, but on the funding side of this, I want to address this. Senator Wicker brought it up, but I want to highlight it again and get your response to just two quick questions, if you don't mind. First, Admiral, in terms of procurement, we actually have some flexibility. You have some flexibility to go multi-year. When it comes to O&M, you do not. Would you agree to go through a pilot program that would allow some flexibility with regard to operation and maintenance funding?
Senator, I would be delighted to have a pilot that we could exercise that concept against, because I think it would send a very strong message to industry partners that we're going to commit to them at a higher level than we can do under the current.
Probably save some money, too. Would you agree?
No question. Yes, sir.
Sir, in the last 45 years since 1974, when the Budget Act was put in place under which we fund our government today, including our military, we have used a continuing resolution 187 times. I would love for both of you, and I've asked every person in uniform who comes before this committee and the Budget Committee to help us understand, because I'm not sure that we do, how detrimental that really is. We have 34 working days. We're staring down the barrel of a gun right now. This year, for the last 2 years, we've been able to avoid continuing resolution. I think that has played some significant role in your ability to recover on the readiness front. However, we could lose all of that momentum, in my opinion, having been around this now for 4 years. I believe we could lose a lot of that momentum just this year if we are not able to fund by September 30th and we end up doing a CR. I've even heard people here talk politically about using a CR through the 2020 election, which would be November of next year. Can you both help us understand how detrimental that would be to what we're doing with readiness and also trying to rebuild our Navy and Marine Corps?
Senator, this is we don't even like talking about it. It's so devastating to our ability to plan and program and have predictable outcomes in the future.
Would you both provide the committee, would get your staff to provide a committee that would give us a summary of how that would impact you this year? I know that General has a very important helicopter coming this year, ready for delivery, could be delayed if we have a CR in September. Would you both commit to do that?
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. One last thing, General, dynamic force deployment, and this is for you too, Admiral. We talked about it, and you were gracious enough to allow me to go visit the Truman the other day, and I was so impressed. Just like I am, every time I see our uniform men and women around the world, the best, and I mean the very best of what we produce in America, is under your command, and I thank you for that. You have survived a pyramid of performance to get here today. Your families deserve the credit. Last question, the dynamic force deployment, help me understand and how that balances off with the operational unpredictability, which is, I think, what Secretary Mattis was talking about when he brought this up to begin with. Can you help us understand how you plan to balance those two?
You want to start?
I will, sir, very quickly. Dynamic force deployment for us as services, working with the chairman and the secretary, is a way of becoming more operationally unpredictable in the way that you described. In other words, we have a set pattern for when we're going to deploy regular units, and intermixed in that is dynamic force employment, which the intent of which is to keep potential adversaries, competitors a little bit questioning, make us less predictable operationally. To get there, though, requires resources on our part, requires a degree of training, because these are not programmed into the regular deployment cycle very far in advance. So we have to work very closely with the chairman, I think, and the secretary to understand where they want to do it and when, and make sure we have the forces ready and the resources available to do it.
Yes, sir, I'll just add that with our first effort on dynamic force employment with the Harry S. Truman Strike Group, that you got a bit of an insight to when you visited there, is we are relearning a lot of lessons we used to do in the Cold War. That's how we employed the force back then. And to relearn those lessons on logistics, supply end chain, end-to-end supply chain, all of those types of mechanisms, they've been in hibernation for 17 years, and now we're bringing them back. So there's some learning here that's going on that is very important. So the benefits of doing this employment scheme are not only the unpredictability for our adversaries, but the predictability on how we're going to operate in that environment in the future.
All right. Senator Hirono.
Senator Hawley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. Congratulations again on your nominations, and thank you for your exemplary service. I want to return to something that you said in response to Senator King, which I think is extremely important, and that is the increasing dependence in the joint force on an increasingly narrow slice of the American population. I think, Admiral, you mentioned that 84% of servicemen and women currently come from legacy military families. And it also strikes me that regionally, and you both talked about the regional balance of recruitment, regionally we are increasingly dependent on families, volunteers, recruits from the Middle West and the South. This strikes me as a very serious concern, because we've talked on the committee all day today about the various challenges that we face as a country and the various challenges placed on the joint force, including fatigue that both of the services you will soon oversee have experienced in the last 17 and 18 years, particularly yours, General, due to the counterinsurgency threat and fight. And those are being borne by an increasingly narrow slice, again, of the American public. What are we going to do about that? And I want to invite you to speak a little more broadly. I think we sometimes talk of it as if it's a military problem. You know, the military needs to do this, that, or the other. It strikes me really is a society-wide problem. I mean, that we have a society that's increasingly disengaged and separate from the mission that we ask you to perform every day. What needs to change in order to reengage more and more of our citizens in this crucial task of defending our country?
I'll start off first. Some of the things that I've seen us do in the last 5 or 6 years, I think, are headed in the right direction. The Third Fleet puts together a force that sails out of San Diego and Camp Pendleton and goes up to San Francisco, Seattle, a couple of other places, and they spend a week there. And this is a way I found, because I wasn't familiar with that, but going up there to see the Marines who are embarked on the ship, A, they get good training, because as a Navy Marine Corps team, you're embarked, you're able to operate. But B, for a whole week, they flood the zone in the community with Marines and sailors, and there's no filters in between them, there's no barriers. It begins to break down the, I don't know what those military people are all about, sort of thing you're focused on. I think they're a step in the right direction. The recruiting the Admiral knows every bit more, probably more than I do, is a week-in and week-out battleground for very highly qualified talent. I don't think that's going to get any easier. We know what we need, and we need to draw it from as many parts of society as we can get, but it is getting harder and harder. We can't shrink into a portion of the country and that become our base. That's a really bad place to head to.
General, let me ask you, again, in the context of the NDS, we ask the Marine Corps to be the Swiss Army knife of the Joint Force in many ways, to do so much in so many areas. As we think about the peer pacing threat, as you put it, in the Indo-Pacific with China, what do you think needs to be done to see the Corps become more a part of the blunt layer force in the Asian theater in particular.
I would lift it up just a half a degree, Senator, and really approach it from a naval force rather than a Marine Corps view. And this thinking on the Navy Marine Corps team is about maybe two and a half, three years old. That contact to blunt force, that layer of forward deployed naval forces, is the best deterrent I know of. And it's instantly convertible to an offensive defensive capability if you have to go there. So what do we have to do? We have to practice the concepts that are outlined in distributed maritime operations. We have to develop the logistics to sustain a more distributed force. We have to harden our network so that we can communicate within that force laterally. And frankly, last part is exercise what our doctrine has always told us, which is empower subordinate commanders to make decisions in lieu of other orders and let them go. In other words, train that way all the time. Our doctrine says we do that, but we can't do enough training at the level where you give broad guidance to subordinates, tell them what you want to accomplish, and let them go. And then we'll talk about afterwards how you might have done it differently.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Duckworth.
General Berger, as my colleague, Senator Ernst, mentioned about the graduating the first integrated recruit training company down in Paris Island. The Marine Corps did this. And I really agree that this was an important progress in achieving a lethal force that is based solely on demonstrated performance and not on personal characteristics or religion or race or gender. I feel that a great nation must embrace its citizens who are willing to put on the uniform and defend their country. So if confirmed to be commandant, how would you succeed where others have fallen short in transforming the culture of the Marines to embrace a truly integrated fighting force? Because you really came into the Marine Corps, you know, in the 80s, and you've seen this change happening, and the culture is shifting, and you've seen us go from where people talked about a front line, you could hide, you know, you could put the women back here, and they could do these support jobs. So there are no front lines anymore. So how are you going to be able to succeed as commandant to change the culture overall of the Marine Corps as you move forward to truly make this integrated force one that is that, you know, faces the modern reality of you can't fight without the women in your force?
Thanks, Senator. I think we're on our way, thanks partly to this committee and Congress in emphasizing it and the service in finding ways to open up occupational specialties and units that women couldn't serve in 5 years ago. That pressure from Congress is healthy, is good. Today, there's almost 500 women who are in units that they could not have been in 5 years ago, weren't allowed to. And that will only grow. We have 200 Marines who have specialties that they couldn't have 5 years ago. That will only grow. I think all of us go into an organization and we want to see role models. We want to see people sort of like us be successful. I think the more that of our units that beforehand were male only, the more more Marines see females in that. As that goes on, I think, to your point, at the end of the day, Marines just care, can you get the job done? This is the standard, and is everybody measured against that? And that's the way it must be. I think the more they see Marines in infantry units and artillery units, and they don't care, like to your point, what gender, what race, where they came from, what hometown, can you carry the load? Can you do the job? That's all that matters.
Thank you. Shifting gears a little bit, as you know, forcible entry amphibious operations have become daunting propositions in today's anti-access and access denial environment. In your opinion, in this era, how must we improve the Marine Corps programmatically and organizationally to ensure that we can execute and oppose amphibious landing against potential adversaries like China, North Korea, and Iran? Again, looking at where you're going, I want to make sure you have that capability.
Just quickly, ma'am, we're never going to pick a symmetric fight. We're going to find – the commanders will find ways so they have an advantage. In other words, we're not going to do another Tarawa or another Iwo Jima. We're going to find a way, if we're tasked to do so, to do a forcible entry in a way that we have the advantage. We need to fight distributed. We need connectors that we don't have right now. It will allow us to move the force from amphibious ships to the shore, spread them out shore to shore. So the family of surface and aerial connectors, that's got to change. That's got to grow. And as far as the training, finding the training environments, the realistic training environments is really tough. A place where there's littorals that represents a spread out area and where you can do high-end training that the Navy Marine Corps needs to do. Now, we're going to need all the help from this committee we can in making sure that those training areas are available to us to train at.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tillis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, thank you for being here and for your service. Congratulations to you and your family for your nominations. General Berger, thank you for the time we spent in the office. We covered a lot of the landscape there, so I just want to go back and talk about one thing that we discussed in the office. It has to do with actually two aspects to Camp Lejeune. One is, I think, the consensus need for the recovery from the hurricane damage that I believe is somewhere in the $3 billion range. And then the other one was family housing, which was damaged. But we had a problem before the storm. The storm, in some respects, masked a fundamental problem that we now know that we have with military family housing across the country. So, one, I'd like to get your assessment of the need for the storm recovery down at Camp Lejeune, and then, two, your personal commitment when you get in there that we're going to continue to do the good work that we started a few months ago when this problem became obvious.
For the storm recovery, Senator, first, you're correct. The total bill, I think the Commandant has been clear, is about $3.6 or $3.7 billion. We're using some reprogramming authorities that we've been given this year to begin to pay what we can. We will need supplemental funds to rebuild Camp Lejeune. And Camp Lejeune is directly tied to combat readiness. So if we can't rebuild the facilities and training areas that we need and the family housing that's got to happen at Camp Lejeune, there's a direct impact to readiness.
And Commandant Neller, you know, like a good Marine, I asked him about the condition of some of these buildings that we have Marines operating in. He said that it was a sort of expeditionary conditions are accustomed to it. That's fine when you're deployed. It's not fine when you're on U.S. soil. So we've got to make sure that we do everything we can to get them up to a sound, operational, safe shape and soon. And you have my commitment to do everything I can on my side of the dais to do that.
That's where it ended. Senator Tillis went on to make a relatively lengthy statement and didn't ask any more questions. So, again, I know some people can consider that stuff boring, but when you hear the problems with shipbuilding, and you hear the data and numbers behind that, I think that stuff's pretty interesting. When you hear the problems of what's going to happen when in 2030 when China has more ships than we do? What do we do? We can't build the ship on time, on budget, to save our lives. And that has implications as it as it reverberates through the budget. So, interesting. And General Berger getting grilled on everything from, you know, reconstruction of Camp Lejeune to integrated recruit training to China and great power competition. And it's kind of interesting, some of the things he said. You know, he's come off the 38 amphibs. So, I believe what, the way I've heard it articulated is that, no, the Marine Corps needs more shipping. Maybe not amphibious, those kind of amphibs, right? Okay. Now I understand a little bit better. So, anyway, I think I love, as you all know, I love that stuff in long format. That'll do it for today. If you're just tuning in, we'll check news next. And there's a bunch of it. To include, I talk about some of the emails and discussions I had yesterday after saying that, you know, many battalions are run by text message, which a lot of people find disturbing. I know I do. It's not about passing information only. So, we talk about that. So on a Wednesday, hump day, the Major League Baseball trading deadline is in 2 hours and 40 minutes. Have a great day on a Wednesday. Elmering Radio over and out.